Hi there, my name is Jo Lenehan and I'm delighted to guest host today's special sustainability episode of the Brown Tamas podcast. I am joined today by fashion sustainability pioneer Dana Thomas. Dana has authored three industry-disrupting books, including Fashionopolis, The Price of Fast Fashion and The Future of Clothes, and is the sustainability contributing editor for British Vogue. We talk about her investigative journalism within fashion, the positive changes happening within the industry, and her passion for fashion, which still burns brightly. I hope you enjoy this conversation with Dana. You are so welcome to the Brown Tamas podcast, and we are just so lucky to have you here in Dublin. How are you keeping? How is your journey here?
It was good. I came from Milan today, and it was a very easy trip and lovely to land in the Emerald Island.
Well, for everyone who's listening who maybe isn't so familiar with your background, I'd love to just catch everyone up. So maybe you can give us a little bit of a whistle-stop tour of your career, if you will, and just tell us how you really became one of the leading voices in the fashion industry today.
Well, it's funny because I don't think of myself as a fashion journalist or a fashion writer. I'm a newsreporter. And I guess that's why, because so many people who go into writing about fashion are fashion people who, you know, come into it because they love clothes and they love shoes and they want to be, you know, fashion editors. But I don't. I mean, I don't dislike clothes and I don't dislike shoes. It was not my passion. I didn't go to art school. I didn't go to fashion school. I went to journalism school. I studied journalism, politics, and history with the ambition to become a White House correspondent or a political reporter or even a war correspondent. And maybe I am in my way. So I started at the Washington Post back when I was still at American University in Washington. The thing was that when I was a teenager, I worked as a model in Philadelphia, New York, Paris, and Milan. And so when the fashion editor heard that there was this ambitious kid on the national desk answering phones who, you know, used to live in Paris and knew how to say Givenchy, he said, I'd like that young woman for my new assistant in the summer. It was a summer fill-in. And I had always thought about my life as a model as something that, you know, I did to pay for college to become a journalist, and that I wanted to be a very serious news reporter. And then I spent this day on the fashion desk, and I was like, oh, I can actually use that information to my benefit. You know, it's not just something I did and I put up on a box on the shelf and left alone. There's something to this. And also, I was lucky because it was the Washington Post. It wasn't Vogue, you know. It wasn't even the New York Times fashion page. Washington's not a big fashion city, you know, beyond covering what the First Lady's wearing. There's not a lot of fashion to write about. So Nina used to write about fashion from a news point of view and covered it like politics and business, because it is politics and business. And so I got into it from that angle, as opposed to coming at it from a women's page, kind of. And then I married a Frenchman and I moved to Paris. And I still did, you know, foreign correspondence for the Washington Post, for Newsweek. But one of the things that I covered often, because it was Paris, was fashion. And it was at a time when the fashion business was changing from small family-run businesses to global corporations, publicly traded corporations that, you know, were turning from becoming, you know, houses to brands, globally recognized brands, being taken over by tycoons who were, who didn't have any fashion background whatsoever. And so this was interesting to write about from a sociological point of view, an anthropological point of view, a business point of view. I became a business writer suddenly because I was just like, look, you know, I'm writing about Gucci going public, you know, and the war of the handbags and the growth of and expansion of LVMH. You know, it wasn't about fashion shows per se, but I would go to the fashion shows to then get an interview with Bernard Arnault about his latest deal. And that was the basis for my first book, Deluxe, How Luxury Lost Its Luster, which was published in 2007 and became a New York Times bestseller. And then from there, I've just kept doing it. And I now write for the New York Times and for British Vogue. And so my second book was Gods and Kings, The Rise and Fall of Alexander McQueen and John Galliano, which is exactly as it sounds. And I really did track how through globalization and the corporatization of fashion, you know, the war between art and commerce became very, got so brutal that it destroyed these two men and a few others along the way. And then my third book was Fashionopolis, The Price of Fast Fashion and the Future of Clothes. And it's really about how all of this change in the fashion business impacted planet and humanity. But it's not just fashion. I use fashion to tell a bigger story because fashion is something you can understand. It's far more interesting, sexy, and relatable to talk about how your jeans are made, because we all wear jeans, and the impact of this has on the environment and on workers and on everything than it is to talk about widgets, right? or deep economic theory. You know, my grandfather was an economist. He used to write these really dry books. I'm basically writing the same kind of books that my grandfather was writing, but I'm using blue jeans instead of graphs and charts. And so then you can understand what I'm talking about.
It's just such an incredible way to view the fashion industry. And it's something that you always come back to, which, you know, fashion isn't just this silo industry. It affects everything. It's so political.
One of the things I learned was, you know, one out of six people somehow work in the fashion industry, whether it's, you know, all from cotton farmers all the way to Naomi Campbell, you know, like it's a broad reaching. You know, it's like an octopus. It goes in all different directions, little arms going, reaching out in all different directions, whether you're in agriculture or you're walking the catwalk.
And then, as you said, because you weren't a fashion journalist, you were an outsider looking in. I think that is what really, and because you're such a serious journalist, those three books were industry disrupting. They challenged so many industry norms because you weren't afraid to ask questions that maybe people who were in the industry shied away from. But having said that, it's still a lot of powerful people and a lot of powerful players to challenge and take on in those books. So where do you find, first of all, the courage to ask those questions? And second of all, why did you go digging into those really dark, challenging topics within the fashion industry?
I don't know if I have courage. I mean, that said, when I was at the Washington Post, I was known as the fearless reporter.
Told you.
And I guess that was because I was raised to always believe it never hurts to ask. And what's the worst they're going to say? No comment?
Okay. Yeah, you're right. But I mean, you make it sound so easy and simple. But, you know, when it is just such a powerful industry and an industry that not only has like a lot of, you know, financial and political power, but also people are very connected to fashion. And so Fashionopolis, for example, everyone needs to read that book. I think it should actually be part of school curriculum because it is life-changing when you understand how supply chains work and what's really going on. And, you know, a lot of people don't want to see that side of fashion because they love dressing up, wearing clothes. So that does take courage, I think.
I guess. But I've always felt like, see, this was that journalism education and background as opposed to coming from an art school or a fashion school where they teach fashion journalism, and people are always asking me to come speak at, you know, their schools and say, will you come talk to my fashion journalism class? And I go, if I do, the first thing I'm going to say is I don't believe there's such a thing as fashion journalism. And then coming from the newspaper, news background, the news side of the newspaper, and being at the Washington Post, you know, the home of Woodward and Bernstein, I kind of had this investigative journalism thing in my bones. This is what I wanted to do. So I decided to do it in the fashion business and or on the fashion beat. And I was lucky that I could because I worked for the Washington Post and I worked for Newsweek, where none of the major brands advertised. They just didn't, you know, they didn't even advertise in the New Yorker till not that long ago. So, you know, that gave these media outlets the freedom to write, to publish these stories without any fear of losing advertising because they didn't have the advertising anyway. So And then my bureau chief at Newsweek used to work for the Washington Post. So he really didn't, his name was Chris Dickey. And he really did push me to do harder and deeper journalism and reporting on these subjects because we had both come from the school of Ben Bradley at the Washington Post and or worked for Ben. And he just said, you know, go for it. Don't worry about it. And don't worry about hemlines. Like, don't do trend stories. I mean, every once in a while you can do a trend story if you feel like it, if there's something really important we need to know about. But otherwise, just go for it and attack it like it's any other beat in the magazine. And so I did. And I kind of created this way of covering fashion that now is very common. And there's a whole slew of kids who have come out through these fashion journalism courses studying my books and reading my work and say, I want to be like Data Thomas. And sometimes they even scoop me, which makes me madder than a wet hen. But then they say, I was inspired by you and I am a fangirl. And I go, okay, well, then I guess I can't get too upset. So I've kind of introduced this whole idea of keeping the business in check by being aggressive reporters as opposed to just buying whatever they say and writing whatever they say and not even questioning it. And it is keeping the business more in check. It really is.
Well, now you're the sustainability contributing editor for British Vogue. So you're very much in a fashion publication there. So I'd love to know, what is your work like there? Like, what's a typical day? How do you decide on the stories you want to write for? I mean, having someone like Vogue investing so heavily in sustainability content, I think is so exciting because Vogue is so powerful. It's such an industry leader. So what is your work like for them now?
Well, it's interesting. What's my day like? I spend my mornings reading. I read. You know what I do for a living? I read and then I write. This is what I do. But I read the trades every morning. I read Sourcing Journal. I read Women's Wear Daily. I read Business of Fashion. I read all these trades. But then I also read like lots of sustainability reports that have nothing to do with fashion, but about planet and humanity. I read UN reports and I read, you know, things that come my way from different areas. And then I'm very lucky. Edwin Enninful last year gave me, I asked if I could have a page in the magazine to write about sustainability. And he said, yes, just like that. Yes. Can you start now? And I'm like, okay. So I thought it would have to go like through committee and get approved, but it was just, yes, done. You've got it. So I write about whatever I want. And nobody ever asks, what are you writing about this month, until I just turn it in, which is kind of great. You know, I mean, that's a freedom I've never really had, even at Newsweek. I mean, Newsweek, if I said, can I do this? They pretty much always said yes, because they said, if you're saying you want to do it, it means we should be doing it. But this, I don't even have to ask. I just send it in and they're like, great, this is great. So that's pretty thrilling. But how do I choose what to do? I don't know. It's my internal radar, I guess. I just figure out what I think people should know about. And then there are always pegs and ideas, like, I'm just received the copy for my June column, and it's about the impact of fashion on the seas, on the oceans, and plastic waste, and how do we clean it up, and businesses that are working on cleaning it up, and brands that are using plastic waste in their items, in their fashion, and I peg that to World Oceans Days. So that kind of made sense, right? You know, like, oh, it's Earth Day this month. So I did a whole thing about trees and the, you know, and how there's a whole kind, you know, there's all these cellulosic fabrics, rayon and viscose, that are made of trees. And I bet you didn't, you know, most people don't know that. So I explained all that and the impact of the trees and how there's sustainable tree farming, but in the end, they're trying to come up with new ways. And there's this new factory in Sweden that's recycling existing fabric, rayon and viscose, as opposed to cutting down new trees. So, you know, it seemed like a good idea to talk about it in April with Earth Month. So, you know, I find things like that, but then also, you know, I just, something's coming up and I think I should know, I should talk about it. Or I take a term in the sustainability movement that you might not understand, and I explain it, like, what is circularity? What is transparency? What is regenerative farming? And I might just do a column on that. I feel like it's a column to inform readers I want it to be something that you learn from every time you, and always go, oh, I had no idea, and oh, that's really interesting. And that's what I try to do. And I'm really thrilled that Edward Enfield has given me this platform to do it. It's kind of funny that, you know, I say, buy less, buy better, which is one of British Vogue's sort of rallying cries. But talk about these things in the beginning of the magazine, and then the rest of the magazine is like, oh, and you can buy this, and you can buy this, and you can buy this. But I kind of like having the, you know, an early page of the magazine to kind of put everything in check before we dive into what do we want to buy, and have a, and basically I call having have a green think about it before, you know, before we go for it, which is important.
It is. And speaking of green thinking, I really want to talk to you about The Green Dream, which is your podcast. And what I love about it is that, first of all, you cover all different kinds of topics within the environmental and social space.
Which just goes back to my newspapering work and my general assignment feature writing. You know, I've always done that. I've never been, like I said, I'm not a fashion writer. I've always covered everything. So I went back to that because I was missing it.
We can thank the Washington Post training for that. And it's, like I said, it's there's something inherently positive about it. And, you know, when it comes to the climate crisis, positivity isn't a word that really comes to mind. But do you think it's important that we stay positive? I mean,
yes.
you certainly bring that across in the podcast.
Yeah, the podcast and even in the column, I try to do that and everything, because basically I read a lot about climate change. I read all morning long every day about different reports, different stories, different writers on the subject, op-ed pieces, think pieces, and they're all really depressing, and it can cause climate anxiety, and you just can feel like throwing up your hands and going, well, you know, let's just go get a chemical-filled drink with a plastic cup and a plastic straw and throw it in the bin. Because it's all going to hell anyway, right? So... like, I have no power, so I give up. I even feel that way when I read all this stuff. So I figure, you know, as I call it, the world's on fire, we're all going to die stories. I can't read any of those anymore. They're just too upsetting, too depressing, and they make you feel powerless. So what I try to do instead is highlight the good news, the positive positive people and forces in the world, and talk about the good works they're doing and the hopeful signs that they're seeing. So, for example, I have a newsletter that goes with this too. So, for example, in one, I wrote about how, you know, we'd heard for years that the Great Barrier Reef is dying, and when it dies, we're all done for, right? And the oceans are dead and we're done. Well, then they did a study and boom, not only is the Great Barrier Reef rebounding because of the environmental work that's been done to save it, but that they discovered a whole new growth that's like virgin, not just restoring what was already there, but a whole new section. So I was like, right, this is what we need to talk about. So, you know, I really do try to find cheerful, goofy, delightful stories and people to highlight, because I feel, and I always ask my guests on the podcast if they have any suggestions of how you and I can do our little bit to make things more effective or better. So when I had the director of the Academy Award nominated film All That Breathes on, Sean X Sen, at the end I said, and it's about these two brothers in Delhi who have a bird hospital, and they're saving birds that fall out of the sky because they're asphyxiated by the air pollution. And I said, is there a way that, you know, listeners can help? And he said, yeah, go on the website. You can support this little hospital if you want to send them a little bit of money or do anything else. You can, you know, I always try to find some way that if you think that this is cool and interesting, you can buy this book, you can go see this movie, you can get on the website and support these people. You can, you know, write them a letter. You can start practicing some of these helpful tips yourself, so that you can come away with it feeling empowered, as opposed to, you know, going to bed with, you know, climate anxiety.
One of my favorite episodes was with a vintage store owner, and you guys spoke a lot about, you know, loving things for a long time. And you actually shared that your daughter wears some of your clothes, which I think is so awesome. So I had to ask, what are your favorite things in your closet that are old, but that you still absolutely love?
Oh, there's all sorts. I mean, I guess the number one is an Alaya coat that I've had since 1983 or four, from when I was a model. And I did an Azzedine Alaya show and he paid me with the coat. I still have the coat. And every time I wear it, people are like, oh, that's a good coat. And it is. It's a really good coat. But, you know, I have some great Tom Ford Gucci suits and shoes. And Lucy's like, could use those. And I have lots of good stuff. I have some old Galliano from the mid-90s that's just in the cedar trunk waiting for Lucy. I don't quite fit into it anymore, but it's really beautiful. And I have, I don't know, there's lots of gems. And I have lots of, I've been a Louboutin client since its second collection. So I have a lot of old Louboutins in the closet and I trot them out, mix them up. My husband, not long ago, said, you're starting to look like Imelda Marcos's closet here. I'm like, oh, come on. It is not even close. And this is 25 years worth of shoes. Okay. Come on. I don't throw away Louboutins. They're too good.
No way. Never.
I take them. And now he has a boutique where he restores them. So I have like this beautiful pair of sandals from about 1999 that were made with sari ribbons. And I took them in. I'm getting them completely redone.
I just love this move towards repairing, which so many luxury brands are.
Because they're too beautiful.
Exactly. And that craftsmanship, like that's the amazing thing about luxury, is that the craftsmanship and the quality means you can repair them, you can pass them down. And it's one of the really inspirational and positive things to see so many brands getting on board with offering repair services. So that's, I guess.
Well, they absolutely positively should. But I mean, if that's part of luxury, that it's supposed to last forever. You're not supposed to replace it every 6 months. But more than that, and what I talk about in Fashionopolis especially, is that, you know, we need to cherish our clothes more. We've been conditioned to think that we need a new dress every time we go out somewhere and to go buy some cheap fashion that looks terrible after two or three wearings or one washing. And so then we toss it and buy something else new because it's so cheap. If it's cheaper, you know, it's cheaper to buy a new one than it is to dry clean that one. And we're not investing any emotion into these purchases or into these clothes, which is a bit of a shame because, you know, you have a great dress that you wore when you fell in love and then you want to keep wearing it, you know, or you have these great shoes that you danced the night away in and you should keep wearing them and have them and love them. You know, I've had that coat, that black Alaya coat's been with me all over the world and it's worked as a blanket on planes and, you know, and a pillow on trains and, you know, made me look really fabulous and I've worn it to funerals and, you know, like it's been part of my life. And that's how we should think, like we do with, you know, beautiful antiques or vintage cars. You know, I drive a 1968 Fiat 500 in Paris. It's that my husband gave me when we got married 30 years ago. It's an adorable little car, but also I just love the little car. I can't imagine life without the little car. You know, we need to bring that idea of loving fashion, not just the style, but also the items and imbuing them with, you know, value and cherishing them again. So you do keep them and keep wearing them and rotating. And fashion now is not like it was when I was even a little kid, where, you know, you could see from one year to the next how things had changed. Now you can wear anything from any time and it's perfectly fine because all the designers are taking looks that were from the 60s, the 70s and 80s and throwing them all into one look one collection like a blender, right? Blending it all up and coming out with new collections. But you have like A-lines and pencils and pencil skirts and smock tops and fitted tops and skinny pants and flared pants and, you know, everything. So it's not like, you know, you could, in the late 50s and the early 60s, even like 1953 to 1963, the way fashion changed was mind-boggling, right? From what my mother was wearing to the prom to what, you know, the hippies were wearing in 1963 and 64. I mean, just completely different, right? Poodle skirts and saddle shoes to you know, the hip to the summer of love in like that. So that's not the case anymore. My daughter can wear my 1999 Tom Ford Gucci suit and she would totally fit in. It wouldn't look like it was 25 years old. And I think that that allows us to keep and love our clothes even more because they don't go out of fashion.
Agreed. That's the enduring power of something that has been made beautifully. So that's, I guess, the rewearing and the loving things for a long time. But I want to turn to more like current and future design now, because there are so many new designers or current designers that are really working on their sustainability and working on their circularity, many of whom are available in the Brown Thomas and Arnold Sustainable Edit, which vets over 5,000 items for across 8 different categories. It's a really great way to shop. So do you have some designers who you think are doing really good work in the sustainability space specifically?
Well, I mean, I write about several in my book, Fashionopolis. And of course, the leader of it is Stella McCartney. And it's not because she's come onto this and decided that she needs to be sustainable. This is how she was raised. You know, as I say in the book, she's the daughter of two of the world's most famous hippies. This is her ethic, and it has been her ethos forever since she was a tiny tot. You know, she's always been vegetarian. She's never worn leather. You know, so she's not having to change anything. What she had to do is get the industry to change with her. And she was seen as crazy when she first started saying these things, and everyone thought she was out of her mind, and they told her she was out of her mind. And now she's like, you see, I told you so. So I think she's great because it's not only sincere, it's been baked in since day one. I mean, as soon as she got out of St. Martin's, her first collection was taking vintage lace, you know, slips and turning them into cocktail dresses. So and using old beads that she found in the flea market. So she's always worked this way. And I just love that she's also nurturing and supporting and even underwriting many of the startups doing new materials and really giving them a place to, you know, she helps them scale up, you know, develop and scale up the materials, and then she folds them into her collection. So she has solutions too. She's like, you know, it'd be nice to be able to make shoes that aren't made of petroleum-based materials. So let's figure this out. And I love that she has the power, and she's the first one to say, listen, you know, I probably wouldn't have this power, and I wouldn't be able to do all this if my dad hadn't been this massive rock star. And I have, you know, the name, and I have the financial might behind me. If tomorrow I lose all my backing, I'll still be fine. But she's not, but she really does believe in it. So, you know, I wear a lot of Stella because it works. And I just know that I'm, you know, she also is the first to say, I know that everything I make leaves an imprint of some sort. You can't make and sell stuff without, you know, but we try to make it at least she's aiming for carbon neutral, and maybe one of these days she'll be carbon positive. And she does as much good works as she can. And she really does try to push the industry to embrace all these things. Like she said, and I thought it was absolutely true, if organic cotton is seen as a luxury, then why isn't the luxury business only sourcing organic cotton? And if they did, then it would be more than 1% of the cotton production. It'd be more like 10 or 12 or 15%. So let's get on with this. And that's what she does. I'm wearing an organic cotton shirt from Stella McCartney right now. And it's the best shirt I have. It's so solid. You feel the difference in the fabric. You feel the difference. You see the difference. It's just such a more noble fabric cloth and material. You see it and you feel it on your skin. So I love what she's doing. But then there's like loads of startups. There's loads of young brands. I can't even keep up with them all. I feel like she's sort of like the flag bearer, and then she has this whole trail of young designers or even people who've been in the business for a long time and decided it was time to pivot to something greener, who were just disgusted by the waste and the impact. And I think it's all great. I think it's all great. And everybody who does their little bit, every bit helps. What makes me really upset and crazy is the brands who are saying they're doing green things and then they're just not, or they're hiding behind it. I mean, it's more than greenwashing. It's like fashion's equivalent of disinformation, and that bothers me greatly. And I just wish if they weren't going to own up to their bad practices, and they really don't want to change them, and they don't because they make so much money the way they do things, why change it if we're making so much money? Then at least stop saying that they're doing good works and be quiet. Just go over there and do what you're doing and be quiet. Then just making up stuff, you know, and then having, you know, young reporters go out there and bust you for it, and then going, oh, but that's not true, and, you know, and how are we going to spin this? I mean, it's one thing to spin politics because, you know, you don't want to, but this is, we're talking about planet and people here, and the impact of all, it touches all of us, and this isn't just spin, this is deeper and more profound than that, and I just wish that they'd either own up to it, be sincere, have some integrity, or just be quiet.
Yeah, and ultimately it makes it really difficult for consumers, because unless you're really ensconced in this, like you and I are, because we're very interested, it's almost impossible for a consumer to decipher. You know, you really need people to be clear with their messaging and just make it easy for people. And side note, I wish everyone could see your stunning shirt, your Stella McCartney shirt, because it is, I can tell even through the screen, it is so beautiful. So
it's a good shirt. And I wear it all the time.
I'd love to really take a leaf out of your own book with The Green Dream and ask, like, for anyone who's listening and has been listening to everything that you've been saying, what can consumers do? You know, we've talked about greenwashing and the challenges there. There are some great people doing great work. There are some really positive stories. But for someone who's listening to The Green Dream or reading your column or soon to be listening to your Substack, what can they do, do you think?
There's lots of little things, and I actually talk about them in the book Fashionopolis. And there is a kids edition of Fashionopolis now for 10 to 12 year olds. So anybody who wants their kids to read it, you can get that too. It's published in America, but I think you can find it in Europe. And I mean, there's really basic, simple, little things that we've just done at home that is not a big deal. Like wash your clothes on the cold cycle, and wash them on the short cycle, because they'll still get clean. And you're not using too much water. You're not wearing out your clothes faster because you're boiling them and spinning them to death. And you're not releasing as many microfibers into the water system. And you're saving money on energy. You're saving money on water. You're saving money on soap. You're saving money all over the place. And you're saving energy. You're saving water. And you're giving your clothes a longer life. Something just as simple as that. It's like not a big deal. Wash your sweaters. Don't take them to the dry cleaners. They're happier for it anyway. And never wash your blue jeans. I mean, not never, but you don't have to wear, you wash them once a month max. They don't like to be washed. They weren't made to be washed. They're the original sustainable item that you just wear and wear and wear and wear and wear and wear and wear. Now, there does come a point they could probably walk out of the room on their own. Then you can wash them. Don't put them in the dryer. But you don't have to wash them after wearing them once or twice. Don't be silly. That denim doesn't like to be washed. So, and especially the denim that has stretch in it, that kills it. So, you know, just little things like that. When you spill coffee on your shirt, you can't get it out, then dye the whole shirt in coffee. I spilled some, a fashion problem. I had some olive oil that exploded in a suitcase and got all over one of my two leather Louboutins. I was like, now what do I do? And my friend said, you put oil on the other Louboutin. I was like, right, okay.
You know, that is my favorite takeaway.
That's what you do. You know, I had a friend who said, you spill red wine on your shirt, you can't get it out. You suddenly dunk the whole thing in the red wine and so that you have a burgundy shirt. Don't throw it away. make a new shirt.
Yeah, it's a lot of it is about taking a lot of the pressure and the rules that we've been told and actually just relaxing and enjoying your things in whatever way that means. I mean, on a consumer individual level, that is, those tips are so achievable and really impactful.
Completely achievable. No big deal, you know?
Yeah. And then in terms of, like, I guess the larger fashion industry, obviously there are players doing great things, but for the ones who are lagging, what do you think is going to help them or force them to turn the dial on what they're doing?
Legislation. Regulation. There are companies out there who aren't going to ever change how they're doing things unless they absolutely positively have to. And then even then, they'll only change what they have to change to meet that specific regulation and not the rest. When I was working on Fashionopolis, one of the things I researched, I spent a lot of time learning and digging in about, was cotton. And, you know, since I was a little kid, DDT, the toxic chemical that they used to use to kill mosquitoes, for example, has been banned because it was killing everything. You know, it was the basis for the book Silent Spring. But there are still countries in this world that still use DDT. And there are some countries in this world that still accept cotton that's been treated with DDT. And so cotton companies, cotton producers, will farm in the countries that still allow use of DDT and sell that cotton to countries where they don't specifically ban cotton with DDT because they don't even think about it because they haven't had DDT since the 60s, just to get that much more markup on cotton. And I thought, right, that's a lot of dancing around loopholes in order to make a few, you know, make some more money. And they will do that. If the EU says you must do this for the EU and the United States doesn't have the same laws in place and South America doesn't have the same laws in place, then the clothes will be made per EU rules for those. The clothes going to Europe will be made for per EU rules that might cost more money. So they lose a bit of money on the markup, but they will still keep making the clothes the other way for the markets that don't have those rules. So we need legislation and, regulation, but we don't just need it like in the UK or in Europe or in the United States. We need it worldwide. We need it to be in sync everywhere. Otherwise, it doesn't matter because these companies, they're huge global companies run by number crunchers, and they will crunch the numbers and figure out how to make more money by getting around those rules.
Dana, I don't want to jinx anything, but it sounds like you definitely have another book in you. And I have to ask, are you planning on writing another book?
Oh, yeah, I'm working. I was working on the book proposal today, but it's not about this. It's about something else. I can't talk about it yet, but it's coming along. It's coming along.
I can't wait. Whatever it is, I know we'll all be chomping at the bit to read it. I can't thank you enough for your insight and your time. Your work has honestly, whether you meant to or not, changed fashion and changed how so many of us interact with it. And thank you so much for chatting with us today.
Thank you. It's been wonderful.